Okay, on page 16, on right column, I want to read verse 13. And in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. Does the term Son of Man mean anything to most believers today? Anything special, anything?
Think about it,
just being Jesus. So if I were to ask the average believer, or maybe even most preachers, what the term Son of Man referenced or referred to, what sort of answers might I get other than maybe Jesus?
God in flesh.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, we're going to spend some time today looking at this thought. Let's read over here, if you will, with me on page 16. I want to read a couple of paragraphs under that verse 13. The revelation is of Jesus Christ. This great vision is of the Son of Man. The great vision that we're looking at right now is of the Son of Man. The fact John wants us to realize is that Christ and the Son of Man are one and the same. John simply says Son of Man and then goes on to his next allusion, which is clothed with a garment down to the foot. To those privy of what the Son of Man means, an immediate and tremendous insight is gained. That is all John needed to say. This is the use of the implied word. The written word is Son of Man. The implied word is all that is associated with the Son of Man. That is the way apocalyptic literature is supposed to work. With one mental picture, an entire message is proclaimed. John's readers and hearers understood this. To those, especially modern readers and hearers, the term Son of Man means little and is read over as though it is of no importance. However, the vision on which we are now focusing is of the Son of Man. This term, Son of Man, is found in the Scriptures 192 times. 192 different Scriptures. It's found in the New Testament 84 times. 84 different Scriptures reference the Son of Man. It's a much larger doctrine than we suspect. It's a much larger doctrine than even taught to us. For example, the term born again is only found three times in all the Bible. But it is a huge doctrine. The term Son of Man is found 84 times, but we hardly know anything concerning its referencing and what it's really about. So I think that tells us that we've missed something on the term Son of Man. Now, as we look through this, and we're going to look at a lot of scriptures, and what I've given you are 84, the 84 times that this term is referenced, Son of Man. What I want to do first, though, is what is it that the term is an allusion to? Now, we talked about allusion links and how, like, this is an allusion link. He says the Son of Man. Now, he means something. And that's all he says, and he goes on to his next point. But what is his point? What is he really saying to us? He says Son of Man, and that's supposed to tell us something, like they that pierced him or the cloud. See, all of these are allusion links. This is how the book of Revelation works. And so if we're going to understand what's happening here, then we need to understand about the Son of Man. So let me show you, first of all, the reference to the Son of Man, where he is alluding to in the part of the Scriptures. And it's in Daniel 7:13. Do I not have Daniel 7:13 here? Come on, surely, Delbert. All righty. Is it on 17? All right, there you go. Okay, look on 17. Yeah. Good, good, good. I should have had it on the open hand. Okay, let's read that on the left column there, Daniel 7:13. I saw in the night vision, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven. Now, do the clouds mean anything to you now? Okay. So he's coming on the clouds of heaven. Now, what is the cloud of heaven? What is this?
The glory of
Glory cloud, Shekinah glory, come on the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. They brought him near the Ancient of Days, or near before the Father, or God. Daniel 7:14. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. Now, what is this a picture of to you? What do you see happening here? Does this bring you into the thoughts of anything?
To me, it's showing God giving Jesus
his kingdom. Okay. All right, good. Right. But when would this have happened? When would the Lord have ascended on a cloud before the Father?
At the ascension.
Okay. All right. So what Daniel is seeing, I think 700 years before it happened, 500 years perhaps. But anyway, long, long time before it happened, was the ascension. And he saw Jesus ascending on the clouds, coming before the Ancient of Days, it says here, the Father, and receiving a kingdom. Now, to me, that tells me that Jesus received his kingdom at his ascension. Does that make sense to everyone? Does everyone kind of follow that? He received his kingdom at his ascension. Then he brought him before the Ancient of Days, and he was given a kingdom. Now, we're not going to turn there. I'm just going to put you in the thought of it right now, and later on we'll be there. But in Revelation chapter 5, this is exactly what happens. John goes up in chapter 4, and he sees the throne and the glass sea and the bow and the creatures and all the elders falling down and all the worship going on and all the angels. And he sees then he says that the Father has in his right hand the seals, the scroll that is sealed with seven seals. And he says, but no man was found worthy on heaven and earth or under the earth to open it. And then he says, and the elder came to him and says, don't cry, for one has been found worthy. And he says, behold, the lion of the tribe of Judah. And I looked and I saw the lamb that was slain from the foundations. So what Revelation chapter 5 is really doing is giving us a video imagery of what Daniel sees here in Daniel chapter 7. And Jesus ascended and he received his kingdom. Now, to this, tell me, does anybody see a parenthetical time, a parenthesis time? Is there ever a time when he won't be king of this kingdom? Is there a 7-year deal in here? A 3.5-year deal in here? What do you see? What do you see when you see that John is alluding back to Revelation? He's alluding back to Daniel chapter 7, talking about the Son of Man. What do you see? Everlasting.
And which shall not pass away.
Shall not pass away. What else does it say?
That which
shall not be destroyed. And this is, and look at the NIV version. Let's read it as well. Daniel 7:13. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So, Jesus is the Son of Man. All of a sudden, we have this tremendous image of a kingdom. We have this tremendous image of the King of the kingdom, him receiving his kingdom. It's an everlasting kingdom. And this is just the beginning of what John is referencing in the Son of Man thought here. So now, what I want to do is, on your papers that I gave you, is I want to look at some of these verses. Now, of course, we can't look at all 84 of those. You can whenever you have your time where you want to do it and look through those things just to see what this Son of Man thing is, because it is extremely important. It's extremely important because this is how Jesus referenced himself. When Jesus talked about himself, he called himself the Son of Man. That's how he talked about himself. Now, what I've done is all 84 of these are here, and I've got them broken down for you in different kind of categories. Every single one of them could come under the first one, where it's the Son of Man was the Lord's favorite way of referring to himself. Because nearly every single one of them is Jesus speaking. It's him talking about himself. So he's talking and referring to himself here. But the first one that I want to show you is this one right here in Matthew 16:13. And this is a very familiar one, and it's Jesus talking here about himself. And it's also the last one that you have on your pages. It's the very last one where it's the Christ. The Son of Man is the Christ. Very last one you have. Matthew 16:13 says, when Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? So he's referencing himself. Now, this is the passage where some say you're Jeremiah, some say you're Elijah, the prophet, you know, John the Baptist raised from the dead. But he says, but who do you say I am? And what did Peter say? You are the Christ. You are the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father which is in heaven. In other words, Peter, you didn't get this one on your own, man. You got the Spirit on this one. And so that's that reference. So when we're thinking now about the Son of Man, then we're thinking about the Christ. And of course, this is Jesus. So I want to look at a few of these, and you've got the references there, and you can look at some too. And if any of them grab your interest as you're kind of scrolling down through there, then let me know, and we'll take a stop and look at it. But in Matthew 12:40, I've got some of them that I just picked out that you'd be familiar with, just to kind of see under the part there where there's 26 references that I put there, that it was the Son of Man was the Lord's favorite way of referring to himself. In Matthew 12:40, it says, for as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Now, have you ever noticed that it was really the Son of Man that Jesus was talking about here? When he says that, I'll be like Jonah. Have you ever noticed that before? Has it ever stuck out to you? Or would you just kind of read through it and just kind of... It's Jesus. Mm-hmm. But see, what is he saying there? He says, what he's saying there is as Jonah was, so is the King. So is the King of the kingdom. So is this Son of Man who's going to receive his kingdom. He's going to be in the earth. All right, and John 6:53, here's another one. Then Jesus said unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, except you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Now, most folks would never realize that he's really talking about eating the flesh of the King and drinking the blood of the King. Now, he is the Christ. We all understand that. But what I'm trying to get you to see is that this is the King of his kingdom. We are partaking of the King. We are partaking of the Christ when we have communion, when we have the flesh and the blood. And this is, do you remember what happened when he said this? Does anybody remember what happened when Jesus said this to the people? They left. And we think it's just because he said, you know, I want you to be cannibals. No. They left because he says, I'm the Son of Man. I'm the dude Daniel was talking about. This upset those Jews. Whenever he would use this term around them, they got all messed up because they understood what the term Son of Man meant. He was saying, he's the guy. You know? I'm the King. I just used those two in that one. This is how Jesus referenced himself. This is how he referenced himself. And the second one, where there's 21 uses that I have for you there, it's the Son of Man who would come quickly in his kingdom even before the disciples had gone to all the cities. Now, really want us to get this point that I made here. In Matthew 10:23, it says, but when they persecute you in this city, flee you into another. For verily, I say unto you, you shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man be come. Now who's coming? The King. He's coming. And he's telling these guys, you're not going to be able to get around to all of the cities of Israel before I come again. Now either he was wrong or we've missed something. Are you with me? Am I clear here so far? And I don't think he was wrong, do you? I don't think he was wrong. I think we've missed something. I'm popping over here and I'm going to move just a little bit. But I think that there's more here to the Son of Man thing. And what he's saying is I'm coming for my kingdom. The Son of Man. The King's coming. And he's coming for his kingdom before you can get around. It's going to be that quick. Before you get to preach this in all the cities, I'm coming. And then in Matthew 16:28, verily I say unto you, there be some standing here, we've already read this one, which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Who's coming? The King's coming. In his kingdom. Now, folks, I am persuaded there's a kingdom. And the saddest part to me is that we're missing it. I'm persuaded that there's a kingdom of God right now. And we've been taught to believe that it's going to come after a tribulation. It's going to come after some temple is built and restored, and we restore animal sacrifices and all of these things. And if I'm understanding this correctly, you know, we're missing the kingdom.
Uh-huh. Now,
right.
But it's like a really oppressed kingdom.
Right.
It's like it's here, but it's not here. You know, they will say the right thing, but what they say and what they think, or what they're thinking about, is not the same thing.
The way it's pretty much portrayed is he is a king, but he hasn't got all of his authority yet. They don't say it that way. They don't know how to say it. It's more like one day he'll get all our authority. You know. Right. They really don't. Well, honestly, you're right. Right.
Well, king over heaven, not earth.
That's true. That's a good way of putting what they do. But mostly, they're waiting on the tribulation. They're hung up on this tribulation thing. And so, anyway, but you're right. All right, I got another couple here that I want to bump. Matthew 24:37. Now, remember, this is the Olivet Discourse. This is where he's talking to his disciples. And 21, so he's just after talking about the Great Tribulation here in Matthew 24:37. He says, but as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. And then 39, which is just under that, you know, that was 37, so in 39. And knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. So it was in the days of Noah. Now, a lot of people will take that particular passage and teach a rapture from it. Two will be grinding, one will be taken, and one will be left. Right? And, of course, the one taken is supposed to be the rapture deal, you know. Two will be in the bed, one will be taken, one will be left. But if I'm reading this correctly, in context, in the days of Noah, the ones that were taken were the wicked. And as it was in the days of Noah, you see. So that's completely out of what Jesus is really saying here. What he's saying is the King is coming. And he says it's going to be in that generation. And he has just said those things there. Okay. How many, have anybody seen The Passion of the Christ yet other than myself? You seen it, Mike? Seen it? Good. And I think all you guys are going to go next Sunday and see it, are you not? Is that what you're going to try to do? You're going to try to do it tonight, I know. But listen, I'm emphasizing that because I really want you to see what you change for me. Okay. There is a scene in The Passion of this verse. Jesus has been arrested and he's been taken to the high priest. And this happens. What I'm saying here, and he uses, now you have to read everything, but it's easy and it's not difficult at all, but he uses the term the Son of Man, and I want to read this to you. It's in the Matthew 26:64. Jesus saith unto him, Thou hast said, nevertheless. In other words, they said, are you the Christ? Let me ask you if you're the Christ. Thou hast said, nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes, and it literally shows him. He just rents it and grinds his teeth, and he's just going wild on it because he says the Son of Man. Then he rent his the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now we have heard his blasphemy. And then they crucified him. So that was that term, Son of Man, that really got him. That was the blasphemy. That's what he's saying. Yeah, I am the Christ, but I'm the Son of Man. And the next time you see me, buddy, I'm coming in the clouds as the Son of Man. And so they knew what that meant. And buddy, he really did. He rent his garments, and it was cool. I was cheering them on then, you know. Luke 21:27. Another one in this one. Then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. So we've already talked about that cloud deal. And, they that pierced him would see him coming in the cloud. And so that's a direct link to the book of Revelation. Then they shall see the Son of Man coming in the cloud with power and great glory. Remember Revelation chapter 1 verse 7 says, and they that pierced him shall see him coming in clouds. Great power. So those are things that, and you've got a bunch of references there that you can look up as well. These are just some that I picked out. And then there was 15 that I put under this lot. It would be the Son of Man that would be betrayed and suffer. Matthew 20:18. Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priest and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death. And this is a well-known passage here in Luke 22:48. But Jesus saith unto him, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man? With a kiss. Isn't that interesting? See, never would have picked up on that before, would you? I mean, I guess we all would have thought, you're going to betray me with a kiss, or you're going to betray the Lord with a kiss, but that's not what he says. Are you going to betray the King with a kiss? Am I getting this across to you? Do you see what I'm trying to say? He wasn't just betraying Jesus. He's betraying the King, the Son of Man, the guy that Daniel's talking about. This is who he's betraying. Okay, and then I had 9 under this. I had some more verses here. What is that? Is the Son of Man. It was the Son of Man who was crucified and risen from the dead. Luke 24:7, saying the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again. The King will rise again. Okay. And Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so the Son of Man be lifted up. He's always referencing the Son of Man. He's always referencing the King. And this really irritated those Jews. It really irritated those people, the Pharisees. I need to learn how to say that different, because it sounds like you're anti-Semitic since all of this stuff going on, and I'm not. But it irritated the Pharisees. And what we came out of the movie feeling wasn't anti-Semitism, but what we've came out of the movie feeling was the hatred towards judgmental religion. You know, a religion that judges and condemns and beats and, belittles people. That's what we came out feeling against. We didn't feel anything towards any particular people. And then I have 6 under the Son of Man rules the kingdom of God. Matthew 13:41. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity. And then this was a good one to me. When I saw this, I really liked this one. What has happened in Acts chapter 7 is they were about to stone Stephen. And you can read there, and Stephen has gone, he's preached to him, and then all of a sudden he comes to this Jesus thing, and they're still gnashing their teeth towards Stephen. But look what happens here in Matthew 7:56. And said, and this is Stephen talking, behold, I see heaven open and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God. And now look what they did. Then they cried out with a loud voice and stopped their ears and ran upon him with one accord. And that's when they stoned him. They stoned Stephen because he said that Jesus is the Son of Man, the King. And then I have four for you under the Son of Man would ascend. Here's a couple of them. John 3:13. And no man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man, which is in heaven. And then John 12:23. And Jesus answered them, saying, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. What does glorified mean to you? What would Jesus being glorified mean? In this particular context, it's his ascending and receiving his kingdom. Be glorified. Be recognized as. Receive his kingdom. Son of Man, the hour's come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Then I have two for you here under the Son of Man in Revelation. We've already looked at 1:13. We spent a lot of time there. The Son of Man in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. And then in Revelation 14:14, it says this, and I looked, and behold, a white cloud. And upon the cloud, one set like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And the next verse says, he said, thrust in the sickle and reap. So he's in this, in that vision that we'll be talking about of that I think is really referencing the Great Tribulation. We've already read the last one that I have there for you, which is showing that Jesus is the Christ. So I want to ask you now, other than saying Jesus, who now to you is the Son of Man? King of Kings, Lord of Lords, the King, having a kingdom, received a kingdom. So to me, he's the Christ who has received his kingdom and is now ruling at the right hand of God. Now ruling. He'll never get all authority. He said, all authority has been given to me in heaven and in earth. You know, and what Daryl said earlier, you know, that they say, right, well, he's ruling heaven now, but he's not ruling earth. Well, that's not what he said. He said, all authority has been given to me in heaven and earth. Now, that means something. He had received his kingdom. And as far as Revelation goes and what we're looking at here, the Son of Man, it was the Son of Man who would come in judgment upon that generation. And what I want us to hold on to the thought until, just hold on to it, don't have to accept it, but just hold on to the thought. But it would be the Son of Man who would be coming upon that generation in judgment. And so I just went back and got some of those verses that I'd already given to you there, just to reference that particular thought. In Mark 8:38-9:1, just reading that, it says, whoso therefore shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he cometh in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. And he said unto them, verily I say unto you, that there be some of them that stand here which shall not taste of death till they have seen the kingdom of God come with power. So he's saying there in those two verses, he says that this adulterous and sinful generation would see the Son of Man coming, and some of those standing there would not die until it happened. And then in Luke 11:30, 31, and 32. Jesus says, for as Jonah was the sign unto the Ninevites, so shall also the Son of Man be to this generation. To what generation? To this generation. Now, what generation is he talking about? Okay. So he's going to be a sign to that generation. The Queen of the South shall rise up in the judgment with the men of this generation and condemn them. The men of Nineveh shall rise up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it. For they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, a greater than Jonah is here. So, as far as the book of Revelation is concerned with the Son of Man, and especially with what we're going to be looking into, is that the Son of Man would be the King coming upon that generation. which Jesus talked about in Matthew 24 as being the Great Tribulation. So that's important when we remember that the Son of Man is that individual who has received a kingdom and who is the King and now rises to the nations with a rod of iron. And that's what the King of Kings does. Now, okay, is that pretty clear? The Son of Man, does the Son of Man mean anything to you now more than it did just about 20, 30 minutes ago? Good. All right. Turn to page 25. On the right side, I want to read. Come down, be the one, two, third paragraph where it starts with another point. And let's read that. Another point we realize, now let me give you some kind of context because I'm changing gears. What we're talking about now are the letters that were written to the seven churches. And I'm discussing here as to who they were written. Now, and another point we realize is the effect upon us of the present and most used interpretation of this chapter or chapters. As explained in the introduction, there are five major approaches to interpreting the Revelation. There's the preterist approach, the historical approach, presentist approach, allegorical approach, and the one used most today, the futuristic approach. The futuristic approach says that though the seven churches were literal, John is actually speaking of seven church ages or eras to come. And a quote here from Tenney, who says, "For the futurist, the letters to the churches represent successive periods of church history, beginning with Ephesus, which would have been the apostolic church, and continuing with Smyrna, the martyr church, Pergamos, the worldly church, Thyatira, the apostolic church, Sardis, the church of the Reformation, Philadelphia, the live church, and Laodicea, the lukewarm church. Their significance did not cease with the end of the apostolic age, for they are different. They are seven different types of churches that may be found in any period of the world's history since Pentecost." Now, what was all that about? The present most popular teaching about these letters in chapters 2 and 3 are that they are not specifically written to churches, but to church ages, beginning with Ephesus being the time of the apostles, and then the next church being the next letter, being the next group of a generation or time period or era of time, and then progressing on unto the end of time. And that's the most accepted and present type of teaching that we have. Now, that entire philosophy doesn't make sense to me. It's actually crazy to me. These letters did go to seven churches. They literally went to the seven churches that were listed here, correct? I mean, we would all agree that they found their way to those seven churches. And what the King of Kings, the Son of Man, told John to do as he looked in the candlesticks and he said, "I saw one likened to the Son of Man walking in the midst of the..." What the King told John to do was to write them to these seven churches. And this is what he says in Revelation 1:11, saying, "I am the Alpha and Omega, the first and the last. And what thou seest, write in a book and send it to the seven churches which are in Asia, unto Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamos and Thyatira, Sardis and Philadelphia and Laodicea." So he told him to do that. Now, and they found their way there. Now, the present day teaching is that each church is a certain amount of time. And if that's what that means, then say... Okay, each church is a certain amount of time, beginning with Ephesus, which was supposed to be in the time of the apostles, right? Which would be a good church, you know. That would be, so all those letters would have gone to good churches, theoretically, if that, using their philosophy. Are you still with me? All right. So there really was a church named Laodicea, But if I were the angel of the church of Laodicea, and I got a letter, though I had a pretty good church, but it said I made him sick and he wanted to spew me out, what do I do with that? Do you understand what I'm trying to relay here? I mean, these letters found their way to these churches. Now, if Laodicea didn't make him sick, and if Laodicea was really a good church, but yet the letter said that it made him, that we made him sick. Now, what do you do with that? Did I make that clear? Do you understand what I just tried to say? Okay. If the apostolic age were all good churches, and we know they weren't, I'm going to hit that in just a second. But if it was, and this doctrine says that they were the good churches, the apostolic ages. Okay. Yeah, the doctrine says they were all good churches, you know, and then each one is decreasing as it moves on towards Laodicea, except for Philadelphia. And for some reason, Philadelphia is totally different from all the rest of them. It's a great church, and it's a love church, and it makes it somehow better than the rest of them. But if I had the church of Laodicea, and I pastored it, and I really didn't make him sick, but he wrote me a letter that said I made him sick, what do I do with that? Well, what I'm trying to say is that the whole thing is, it just doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't work when you really think, if these people were living in that time and the letters weren't for them, it'd be like him writing us a letter talking about the year 4000. Right. Am I right?
What church? What church would the letter be to now?
Well, today Laodicea. Any generation is always Laodicea. Whoever is interpreting. They're always the Laodicea church. But what do you do with this, Daryl, where Jesus says, I'll build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it? Now, I mean, so Jesus can't build a church, huh? I mean, he does. I mean, and nothing works with it. Nothing. And we know that all the churches in the apostolic age were not good. And the letters that he wrote to the church of Corinth were nothing but straightening them out. And he told Galatians, man, I wished I hadn't even started you. Wished I hadn't even done anything with you guys. You know, you've gone backwards on me. You know, talking about the circumcised, I wish you just cut it all off. You know, that's what he says to him. I mean, he's just fed up with them. I mean, there were not good churches in that age, and so to say that all of those guys were good, and then it depreciates, and all of a sudden we jump back up to Philadelphia, and then we fall back off to Laodicea, and then some people teach it as though that the Philadelphia and the Laodicean churches are at the same time. So what I did to try to help us. Yeah, really, really, really. And of course, we know who the author of confusion is. And so if he can get us all confused and even divided on how we interpret or whatever, then no two people are going to see everything identical anyhow, no matter who you are. But anyway, what I've done is I've tried to do some charts for us. I think I want to read first, on page 26 again, let me read this, and then we'll do my charts that I went and found. On the left column, come down, skip the next paragraph where we stopped reading, where it talks about the futurist, and come down to the next paragraph where it says the comments of Phineas. You know who Phineas J. Dake was, don't you? The Anointed Bible. He made his Bible, put his notes in it, and anointed it with oil. He's the author of that one. The comments of Phineas Jennings Dake are interesting, especially knowing that he was a dispensationalist. Nonetheless, he wrote, the dispensational application of these church letters, i.e., that they portray seven church periods or phases of church history, is really based on human theory alone. There can be no scripture produced to prove this theory in any one aspect. Similarity to certain phases of church history proves nothing. And then skip down the next two paragraphs into the paragraph that starts with one continuous aspect. One continuous aspect of the futuristic doctrines concerning the different church times is they cannot agree with each church age or era was. Now, what did I just say? They in themselves, as they interpret it, they can't agree. Like you were just talking about. They can't even agree on what church era was here and when this time was and when that time was, they can't even agree. When their own personal writings and teachings are viewed, they contradict themselves as above. All that have ever believed the church age doctrine, think their generation is living in the Philadelphia Laodicean time. Of course, all have been inaccurate. Now, let me show you these charts. I went online and I just read. I didn't have to search a long time. I just typed in a search for church charts, and I got the first four, and I just did them. And down here are it didn't show up very well, but do you see where I've got the web page? So if you want to go to them, then there they are. There's the web address, and I think I have it on each one of them. But anyway, on this particular one, let me do this. Right. This particular one, this guy, he gives what he thinks these churches, their names mean, and he draws, I guess, some something from there. But here's where I'm looking at this line here, where this one was from A.D. 33 to A.D. 312, A.D. 312 to 590, 590 to 517, and he progresses right on up from 1905 to the present, the Laodicea church. So what he kind of does is just everything just goes downhill, and that's what he does. Now I know you can't remember these numbers, but I've got a deal at the end that'll help you. All right, then here's another chart, and again the same seven churches, and then here are his numbers, and he hooks up some kind of scripture references, and I looked and I couldn't find anything that would really help me as far as understanding it. But here are his dates. And you can see again that each church age, he does, and I know you can't compare them by memory, but they are different from the previous guy. And then there's the web address down there at the bottom as well. If you wanted to write that down. Is anybody writing that down? I can. That's not a big deal. I can. All right. And then here's another chart. I'm just showing you these different charts. And again, he does the same deal, and now he even puts, you know, the church is raptured after Laodicea. The problem is, his is 910. 1910 is where he ends up here, and so he's still waiting on Revelation 4 or 5. And you can see his dates, which were totally different from the other two. And then here's a fourth chart. Now this guy's in real big trouble because his date, he ended it at 1917. And it's the end of the age right there, you see? That's the end of the age. It's all done. And his dates were, of course, different from the others. Now, what I've done here is consolidate all four of those charts and just show you that the first guy, you know, he gives us 33 to 100. Well, the second guy gives us 33 to 270. The third guy gives us 63 to 170. And then the fourth guy gives us 96 to 100. And so you see all of these that are just vary and differ. And this guy here, he goes from 590 to 1517. Well, this guy goes from 1530 to 1730. And so do you see what I'm trying to show you? Is that even in their own doctrine, even if you believe that these are seven different church ages, it's still all goofed up. You know, they still are not consistent. They can't prove with any consistency when a church age was. And the reason is because it wasn't written to church ages. It was written to seven specific churches that exist in every age. Right now, all seven, you'll find all seven of those kinds of churches in our city. You know? And probably all seven of those things happen in every single church if you were to really dilute it down. You know what I'm trying to say here? If you really were to bring it down, you've got to deal with all of these things. So anyhow, that's what all this is about. Now, if I totally confused us or helped us or done anything, you know. So this is the deal. This is the teaching that they want us to buy into. And it's according on whose chart you read or who you listen to. And the problem with it is that it just never works. It never adds up. It never pans out. I have got these right here. I can run you some copies of these off if you want them. So the bottom line is that none of those theories, and that's what they are, and even Dake said so, none of those theories really work. What will work, and what will work every time, is if we really take the Bible for the Bible and let the Bible teach the Bible and really believe that what Jesus told John to do is really what it meant. Revelation 1:11 says, you know, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write these letters to these seven churches. And these seven churches existed. They were real churches. They really existed, and these were real cities. And some of these cities are still in existence. Some of them are not, but some of them are. But that's how we're expected to interpret the book of Revelation if we interpret it using the present dispensational doctrine, is that each one of these churches is a church age. I can't see that. I can't go there. And to me, that's just not what it really means. So, page 26, again, on the right column over there. And we'll close up. I was looking for something just to kind of, encourage you guys. And this has not been a real, edifying kind of a lesson this time. But I really was just looking at something, and because I know I've given you a lot of information, and that's what you're really here for. But I was reading this, and in Revelation chapter 2, on the right side over there, do you see where I'm at? Revelation 2, verse 2. Let's read that. I know thy works, and thy labor, and thy patience, and how thou canst not bear them which are evil. And thou hast tried, and that word means test. You've given those a test, which say they are apostles and are not, and hast found them liars, and hast borne and hast patience. For my name's sake hast labored and hast not fainted. I just wanted to applaud you guys. The reason is because, you're serious about this, and you're taking your time to try to find out, what does this really mean? Does it mean more than I've experienced? Is there more to this? And I applaud you. You're putting it to the test. And he's not here tonight, but I was talking to Troy. And Troy just is really taking time, and I know Marty's done it as well. But he's took time, and he's looked these scriptures up, and he's run references, and he's looked at it. And I know that that's what you guys are doing. You're putting it to the test. And what I'm trying to tell you is that that pleases the Lord. And He's going to bless you because of it. But the main thing that's going to happen is you're going to come out of this thing understanding some things that not a lot of people do. You're going to have some insights into the kingdom. You're going to have some insights into the book of Revelation, of course. But you're going to know some things, and God's going to bless your life. And I just want to thank you, and I applaud you for your time, your labor, coming on Sunday nights, listening to me talk and rattle on and on. And anyway, I just wanted to end with that particular verse because I want you to put it to the test. And for more than one reason, if I'm wrong, I want somebody to tell me I'm wrong. I want you to just not tell me, but show me. I've had a lot of people tell me I'm wrong. But nobody's shown me I'm wrong. And that's what I really want to do. Well, let's pray, and then I'll cut this thing off and ask if you got any questions. We can change.